A good day.
Today is Wednesday, April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The European Union's top two officials have strongly criticized Turkey's human rights record after meeting with the Turkish president in Ankara.
The EU has to start believing that in its own capacity to speak out on what's going on.
Plus, authorities in Myanmar have arrested the country's best-known comedian as they continue to crack down on people they accuse of helping incite nationwide protests against the February 1st military coup. We'll have these stories and more next. The European Union's top two officials have strongly criticized Turkey's human rights record after meeting with the Turkish president in Ankara. But as Dorian Jones reports, the EU leaders also said the two sides would continue to work together.
European Council President Charles Michel and EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for talks on a reset in relations. After meeting Erdogan in Ankara, Michel spoke to reporters about the EU's deep concern over human rights in Turkey.
The rule of law and respect of fundamental rights are core values of the European Union. And we shared with President Erdogan our deep worries on the latest developments in Turkey in this respect, in particular on the freedom of speech and the targeting of political parties and media.
State prosecutors last month opened a closure case against Turkey's second largest opposition party, while Ankara withdrew in April from the Istanbul Convention, a European treaty that legally protects women. Emma Sinclair Webb of the New York-based Human Rights Watch has been calling for a tougher stance by the EU.
The EU has to start believing that in its own capacity to speak out on what's going on, and to look at the crisis and to actually condemn what's going on in much stronger terms.
But Michel and von der Leyen did welcome Turkey's talks with EU member Greece to resolve territorial disputes over the Mediterranean and Aegean seas, which are believed to have vast energy reserves. The EU officials said talks with Turkey would start on modernizing a customs union agreement, a key Ankara demand. Sinan Ülgen of the Istanbul-based İdam Research Institute says the customs union talks will give the EU new leverage, which is important as Turkey's EU membership bid is all but dead.
The accession track has stalled, has remained dormant and dysfunctional over the past few years. And the EU now has very little leverage over Turkey, given that there are very few avenues of, you know, positive engagement.
The EU officials also said they expect Turkey to fully honour its commitment to a migration deal, including accepting migrants and refugees back from Greece. Ankara is pressing for more EU funds to help accommodate nearly 4 million Syrian refugees, a demand that von der Leyen said the European Union was ready to consider. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Authorities in Myanmar have arrested the country's best-known comedian as they continue to crack down on people they accuse of helping incite nationwide protests against February's military coup. The comedian, Sir Gunnar, was taken from his home in Yangon by police and soldiers who arrived in two army vehicles. The comedian is a satirist who has been in and out of prison since he was active in a failed 1988 popular uprising against a previous military dictatorship. Hunter Marston is a PhD candidate at the Australian National University and a non-resident WSD Honda Fellow at Pacific Forum. I asked him if he saw parallels between the junta's present actions and those of previous military governments.
Well, I think the late 2000s give a pretty clear parallel to the current path. Myanmar's generals had held on to power after cracking down in 1988 against nationwide protests, holding elections on their terms in 1990, which they then refused to acknowledge the results of. There were protests throughout the 90s and international criticism But in the 2000s, Myanmar's generals began to signal a willingness to pursue what they called a roadmap to disciplined, flourishing democracy. And at the time, ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, had been pressuring Myanmar to reform and open up to the world and become a better, more responsible stakeholder within their community. And the United States, of course, and other Western governments had lobbied and pressured Myanmar's junta to change away from its dark past and the human rights atrocities that it had committed for decades. But Myanmar's generals were also sticking to their roadmap to disciplined, flourishing democracy and refusing to budge on ASEAN's terms. But, you know, I think one case that offered some insights into Myanmar's tolerance for pressure and willingness to adapt was the 2008 Cyclone Nargis, which killed hundreds of thousands and displaced more in the country. At the time, ASEAN had been pressuring Myanmar to open up to the world and accept humanitarian assistance. And in this case, ASEAN was successful in allowing in international aid in conjunction with the United Nations. So that's one example I would point to as a success story in the past that we could perhaps look to going forward.
Now, was it just ASEAN and other international partners, as well as the natural disaster, that really tipped the scale in terms of creating that fledgling democracy in Myanmar? Or was there more domestic pressure put on the military leaders to turn that corner?
Well, the 2007 Saffron Revolution certainly exposed the unpopularity of the regime and the deep discontent across the country. So that started to get the ball rolling from within Myanmar. And the generals had put forward that year this roadmap or plan to transition to manage democracy on their terms. But Myanmar wasn't willing to budge to ASEAN and didn't show much sign of actual change until they were able to proceed with their path on their terms, dictate the terms of the 2008 Constitution, which enshrined the role of the military. And then their engagement with ASEAN did expand after that. But I think it shows two things, that Myanmar and the generals in particular are very reluctant to accept outside criticism. And if anything, it sort of pushes them into further stubbornness. But at the same time, it shows that there is prospect for change if this is managed in a multilateral sense with other stakeholders.
So, Hunter, as someone who is aware of Myanmar's past and has been watching the events unfold closely in Myanmar since that February 1st coup, what are some of the things that you're keeping an eye on as indicators as to what may take place next?
Well, a few things. I'm watching to see how much international traction the committee representing the Pidongsuz Lhota, or the CRPH, what people are calling a shadow government, the elected leadership gets internationally, and how much it's able to provide basic services within the country to, in a sense, say we are the legitimate representative body of the Myanmar people, and we're delivering governance at a local level. They've already set up medical centers to account for striking hospital staff that have left their jobs. And it'll be essential to show that they're capable of managing the country. Another component I'm looking closely at is the role of ethnic armed groups and the decisions they make in coming days and weeks to side with the protest movement or not. Some so far have voiced support for the protest movement and said that if the military continues to kill civilians, that they will take a more active stance. Some have sort of sat that fight out so far. But if all of them combined opposed the military and actually engaged in armed conflict once again with the military, and these conflicts have gone on for decades off and on, but if they were to erupt simultaneously, that would put an enormous degree of pressure on the junta to probably pursue some form of negotiated settlement. And a third factor is how long the strikes and protests can continue within the country and whether they're able to sustain hope of a democratic transition.
That was non-resident WSD Honda fellow at Pacific Forum, Hunter Marston, speaking to me from Canberra, Australia. Iran and world powers held what they described as constructive talks Tuesday. They agree to form working groups to discuss the sanctions Washington might lift and the nuclear curbs Tehran might observe as they try to revive a 2015 nuclear deal. European intermediaries have started shuttling between Iranian and U.S. officials in Vienna as they seek to bring both countries back into compliance with the accord, which lifted sanctions on Iran in return for curbs to its nuclear program. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018, prompting Iran to steadily overstep the accord's limits on its nuclear program, designed to make it harder to develop an atomic bomb, an ambition Tehran denies. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The Izvestia newspaper reported Monday that jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny has been moved into a sick ward with symptoms of a respiratory illness and has been tested for the coronavirus after he's said to have had a high temperature and cough. Reuters' Soroya Ali has more.
Russian police have detained a doctor and ally of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Anastasia Vasilieva was one of dozens of supporters protesting outside Navalny's prison, demanding that authorities give him proper medical care. His allies say he has a high temperature and bad cough. Three inmates in his ward have been hospitalized with tuberculosis. Navalny, a prominent critic of President Vladimir Putin, announced a hunger strike last week, saying that prison authorities refused to treat him properly for acute back and leg pain. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said he would be treated appropriately like any other prisoner if ill, but declined to comment on his condition. Navalny's allies have vowed to stage a rolling protest outside his prison unless he was examined by a doctor of his choice and given what they regard as proper medicine.
Soroya Ali reports for Reuters News. A new International Monetary Fund forecast foresees a period of global economic growth ahead. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that story.
The IMF says the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines and vast sums of government aid will this year kickstart growth to a record high in a powerful rebound from the pandemic recession. The 190-country lending agency says it expects the world economy to expand by 6% in 2021, up from the 5.5% it had forecast in January. It would be the fastest expansion for the global economy in IMF records, dating back to 1980. IMF chief economist Geeta Gopinath tells reporters a way out of this health and economic crisis is increasingly visible. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Israeli President Reuven Rivlin on Tuesday announced his decision to mandate Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to form a new government. This after an inconclusive election, giving Netanyahu a new lease on his political life. Reuters reporter Emily Wither takes it from here.
The country's longest-serving leader now faces the tough challenge of enlisting enough allies for a governing coalition. Under law, Netanyahu will have 28 days to do so. Announcing on television his choice of Netanyahu, President Reuven Rivlin cast doubt on any candidate being successful. The announcement came as his corruption trial entered its second day in a Jerusalem courthouse. Rivlin said that under Israeli law, Netanyahu, as the current prime minister, was not disqualified from being assigned the task, despite his indictment on corruption charges. Charged with bribery, breach of trust, and fraud, Netanyahu has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the prosecution of an attempted coup.
This is how they try to overthrow a powerful prime minister from the right. This is what a coup looks like.
Israel's election on March 23rd was its fourth in 2 years. It ended with neither a Netanyahu-led right-wing and religious bloc, nor a prospective alliance of his opponents, capturing a parliamentary majority. Continued deadlock could ultimately result in a new election.
Emily Wither from Reuters News. Jordan banned all news outlets and social media users on Tuesday from publishing any content related to King Abdullah's half-brother, Prince Hamza, after the latter was accused of plotting to destabilize the country. Prince Hamza pledged allegiance to King Abdullah late on Monday after mediation by the royal family 2 days after the military warned him over actions it said were undermining security and stability in Jordan and placed him under house arrest. While not considered a direct threat to the king, Hamza in recent weeks visited tribal gatherings where the king and his government have been criticized more openly. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte says he is committed to peacefully resolving a diplomatic row with China over the disputed South China Sea. It was a measured response after days of strong rebukes by his ministers and generals. The continued presence inside the Philippines' exclusive economic zone of hundreds of Chinese vessels that it believes are manned by militias has frustrated Manila and drawn concern from the United States, among others. In addition, a Chinese carrier group is exercising near Taiwan, and such drills will become regular in a further escalation of tensions near the island that Beijing claims is its sovereign territory. Scott Harold is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and I asked him how he views these latest developments.
Well, I think there's two core ways to look at this. Kind of one is in the context of the broadest level of Chinese foreign policy. And then the second is a slightly more operational look at how the PLA and Chinese security policy fits within that. So at the broadest level, I suspect you're very knowledgeable listeners, Steve, know that that Chairman Xi Jinping has been pushing the notion of a China dream of national rejuvenation that seeks to, quote unquote, restore China to its rightful place as a leading, probably the preeminent power, if not in the world immediately, then certainly at least in the Indo-Pacific today. And that has been behind kind of this growing assertiveness or aggressiveness by Chinese foreign policy. Well, in fact, even before Xi Jinping came in back into the late 2000s, when many in the Chinese leadership concluded that the West was in decline and the time for China to advance more aggressively had arrived. And in particular, since Xi Jinping has come in 2012, 2013, that has only grown in urgency. Operationally, from the early 1980s onwards, when Deng Xiaoping came in and in the late 70s and into the early 80s, kind of decided or determined that the main characterization of the international society was that it was no longer likely that there would be an early major or even nuclear war, that instead there would be local and limited conflicts. That really turned the PLA to a new set of missions focused on what the Chinese have called rights protection, or trying to use their Navy, their Coast Guard, and their maritime militia to advance China's disputed claims.
I want to follow up on that last statement that you did, because, you know, back in 2016, the International Court of Arbitration ruled in favor of the Philippines regarding to China's expansion in the South China Sea. And we have seen more activity by Chinese vessels in disputed waters. So are you foreseeing a perhaps increase in conflict, not only with the Philippines and China over disputed areas, but other claimants with China?
I mean, I think if you look at the writings of a number of leading Chinese proponents or exponents of China's foreign policy, many of them, academics who also consult with the State Council and receive funding to write things to justify or explain Chinese foreign policy, many of them have written things that essentially argue that as the point comes closer and closer when a power transition is going to occur, where China is going to catch up to and or surpass the United States, that at that moment it is appropriate for China to begin to drop some of the facade of a peaceful rise and to accept greater and greater conflict and friction, turbulence and troubles in its relationship with the outside world, with the idea being that, look, you know, if you're going to overtake the world's most powerful country, you have to expect that that will not be, as Mao Zedong once said about revolution, a dinner party. And I think the Chinese are very much prepared, and we've seen this pushback against the outside world on almost every front. And so, yes, I think it's likely that we will see additional pressures on other claimant states in the South China Sea.
I'd like to turn our attention to Taiwan. The government there said that they were concerned about China's announcement that it was going to carry out routine maritime naval drills near Taiwan. But, you know, China has always viewed Taiwan as a wayward province, and the United States is moving in the Theodore Roosevelt group for another set of exercises. Is Taiwan, you know, justified in its concern, given that China has in the past done other military drills in the area?
I think Taiwan's absolutely justified to be concerned. I will say I think Taiwanese analysts, the Taiwan government, have always been concerned. Let's remember, this is in many ways a threat that dates back 70-plus years, as you know, Steve. And in fact, China has been ramping up its aerial incursions into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. There's also a thought that by doing these kinds of exercises, China can blur the indicators and warnings. By routinizing its activities around Taiwan, it can make it more difficult for Taiwan, the United States, and other countries to determine when something actually new is happening. When is China actually making a move to carry out a kinetic attack on Taiwan? Or, oh, no, this is just another exercise. We've seen them do this for years. Don't get overexcited. And then use that to kind of gain a running start that would make it more difficult for countries that might want to come to Taiwan's aid in an actual war to ramp up themselves and get ready to move out. So I think there are many good reasons for Taiwan to be concerned. And the final one I would point to, well, actually it's two, would be the testimony in early March of USINDO PACOM commander Phil Davidson and his nominated successor, Admiral John Aquilino, both of whom said that they feared in the case of Admiral Davidson that a Taiwan contingency could come in the next 6 years. And Admiral Aquilino said that he thought it was much closer than most people expected and could come even sooner than that, potentially.
RAND Corporation senior political scientist Scott Harold. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations reports more than 11,000 people have fled the coastal town of Palma in northern Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province since insurgents attacked the town nearly 2 weeks ago. Lisa Schlein has more.
Civilians arriving in Pemba, the capital of Mozambique's Cabo Delgado, are telling aid workers that thousands of people are trapped inside Palma and the surrounding area. They also report that people fleeing Mozambique have been refused entry into nearby Tanzania. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Baluch says it is very worrisome that people fleeing for their lives are being prevented from seeking asylum.
More than 1,000 tried to cross into Tanzania, tried to cross the border from Mozambique into Tanzania, and they were turned back. So at this stage, we don't know how this happened, who did this, but we are trying to seek clarification from the authorities on the other side inside Tanzania.
The UNHCR is appealing to Mozambique's neighbors to allow entry to people escaping violence and seeking protection. Dozens of people reportedly were killed by Islamist militants who attacked Palma on March 24th. Thousands of people have been displaced, and the economic fallout from the onslaught is potentially huge. The French energy giant Total has suspended its multi-million-dollar liquefied natural gas project in the area. Baloch says his agency and others are scaling up relief efforts for the thousands of destitute, deeply distressed survivors of the attacks in Palma.
The majority of new arrivals are women and children who are coming with few belongings, most showing signs of severe trauma following the atrocities they witnessed and are worried for those relatives who were left behind. The sudden and deadly nature of the attacks have left families torn apart, many still unable to leave.
Baluch notes, many children are unaccompanied when they arrive. He says efforts are being made to trace and reunite them with their families. Baluch adds the needs are immense. They range from basic relief, including food, water, health care, and shelter, to psychological counseling and protection from gender-based violence and sexual exploitation. The UNHCR warns it will be unable to properly assist the displaced without more generous support from donors. It recently appealed for $19.2 million to help Cabo Delgado. To date, the agency says less than 40% of that has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Teachers in Malawi's public schools have resumed a nationwide strike after the government backed out of a promise to pay bonuses for COVID-19 risk. Malawi authorities say the government has no money to pay the teachers who risk contracting the coronavirus by teaching classes in person. Lamek Masina has the details.
Malawi's public school teachers resumed their nationwide strike Tuesday after the government did not honor a promise to pay bonuses for their risk of contracting the coronavirus while on the job. President of the Teachers Union of Malawi, Willie Malimba, said they began the stop week action after authorities failed to meet a 7-day ultimatum.
We felt cheated on this one because we agreed, and at that time it was a high-level meeting. We did that one at Parliament. So we had a presidential task force. We had a committee of education when we were making that agreement.
Malimba said teachers take risks when working in packed classrooms during the pandemic and will not resume work until the government gives them the promised bonus. But Malawi's government says teachers were not among those budgeted to receive a COVID-19 risk allowance. Malawi government spokesperson Gospel Kazaku says despite what was promised, they do not have the money to meet the teachers' demands.
People can squeeze government, but if government doesn't have a resource, it doesn't have a resource. And you must know that we are not doing these things out of malice or that we are careless. No, we are not.
Kazaku is also Malawi's information minister and a member of the presidential task force on COVID-19. He says they will meet the teachers on Thursday to discuss their welfare, but not the bonus, which he argues would be short-term anyway.
Teachers have a lot of problems beyond COVID allowances. We need to sort out their salaries. We need to sort out their conditions of service. We need to sort out the housing allowances, so many other things, not just be, you know, COVID. The thing is, assuming in the next 3 months there is no COVID, it means they will not have any allowance.
Steve Shala specializes in education for the Nairobi-based nonprofit African Institute for Development Policy. He says the government should reach a deal with teachers so that Malawi's students don't lose any more class time.
It would be important for government to be quite open about what's going on. If they say there is no money, that's not enough an explanation. It's possible for the government to have no money, but to come up with an explanation that the teachers can understand and can compromise, and then they can resume work.
Malawi's teachers first began striking in January after months of being closed due to the coronavirus. They resumed work in February after the government promised to give them money to buy personal protective equipment. Malawi first closed the schools in March 2020, even before it confirmed its first cases of COVID-19. The government reopened the schools in September, only to suspend classes again in January after a surge in infections, including among some teachers and students. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
A Minneapolis, Minnesota Police Department use of force instructor testified at the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin, who was charged in the death of George Floyd. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Lieutenant Johnny Mercil says officers are trained on restraining combative suspects using a knee.
We tell officers to stay away from the neck when possible, and if you're going to use body weight to pin, to put it on their shoulder and be mindful of position.
Several experienced officers, including the police chief himself, testified George Floyd should not have been kept pinned on the pavement for close to 9.5 minutes.
How long, based on your training and experience, does it typically take to render a person unconscious using a neck restraint?
My experience is 110 seconds.
Tape from Court TV. Records show Chauvin underwent training in the use of force in 2016 and 2018 and had been certified to perform CPR. I'm Ed Donahue.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.